This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody, to Crimes and Consequences. I'm kind of going back to our roots today. This episode is really gruesome.
Oh, man. We haven't had a super gruesome one lately.
It's a 10.
Oh, shit. Really?
Yeah. There's a father, his two adult children, and a male teen were sadistically tortured for hours in a barn in a property known as the Burnt House Farm. And Tanya, the violence against them was gratuitous and wickedly shocking. But even more stunning is the fact that one of the killers escaped justice and lived a life of luxury.
Oh, I hate it.
Under assumed name for 16 years. Again, this story is gruesome and much of this episode will be graphic.
Ooh,
a lot of it.
So if you can't take it.
You've been warned.
Yes.
Don't email us. Saying, you didn't let me know it's going to be so bad. I'm letting you know.
It's bad.
It's bad. But before I get into all that, I'm going to give you some background. And I'm going to ask you guys to hit the follow button on whatever app you're listening to us on. Are you ready?
Absolutely.
44-year-old Brian Waters was a loyal and devoted husband and father. His family described him as nonviolent, kind of a hippie kind of guy who enjoyed smoking weed and relaxing with friends. Kind of like me in college. But for this story to be told properly, you must know another aspect of Brian. Brian sold drugs for a living, mostly weed. His principal business was in Holland, where marijuana could be legally sold in areas in Amsterdam. But in 2002, he rented some property known as the Burnt House Farm. And that is in Tabley, near Knutsford, in Cheshire, England. Brian, along with an old friend named Mujahid Jahid, I'm sure I slaughtered that, but thankfully he goes by Johnny, set up a cannabis farm there. This sprawling property was comprised of a large brick farmhouse, and I saw some pictures of it. It appeared to have a chicken coop, a cow shed, multiple barns, and multiple buildings on its perimeters. And then it was all surrounded by fields. I'm sure at one point the Burnt House Farm was a thriving farm, but now it is where Brian Waters and his friend Johnny grew marijuana. If you're imagining a high-tech grow operation like what is happening in the United States now with all these marijuana companies, you'd be very wrong. The marijuana plants were grown inside the old farmhouse in clay pots, and they were watered with hoses. The operation was profitable, but neither Johnny nor Brian were living a life of luxury. In 2002, they earned about $1,500 cash each monthly, which is roughly $3,500 or $4,000 in the U.S. Brian frequently traveled to Holland because that's where his main cannabis farm was. As most of you know, in 1976, weed in Amsterdam could be sold legally at coffee shops. And throughout all of Holland, the marijuana laws were really relaxed. It was usually misdemeanor. However, once you cross that border, it's illegal again. And Brian often traveled back and forth from England to Holland, and he would broker deals for other suppliers along the way. In 1999, during one of his trips, Brian was searched by customs at the border in Dover, and $22,000 in cash was confiscated from him.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it wasn't his money.
Oh, shit, Billy.
That money belonged to a hard-lined criminal named John Wilson, a well-known drug dealer from Manchester, England. Brian was now indebted to John Wilson, and he promised to work off what he owed. And I think he would do that by not taking any cut of the negotiations. But don't quote me on that. A few years went by, and Brian slowly, very slowly, whittled away at the debt he owed John. Although Brian was a nonviolent man, in the underground world of drugs, that was an anomaly. His associates often didn't share the same temperament as he did. In the winter of 2002, Brian ran into some more bad luck. While doing a deal for John Wilson in Manchester, Brian was robbed of several thousand in cash, and John Wilson was robbed of his patience. Now Brian owed him even more money, and John knew he was not going to get that money back for a while. It'd been 3 years since Brian got stopped at customs, and he still hadn't paid all the money back. John Wilson had heard rumors that Brian was growing weed on a farm in England, but Brian never told anybody where this farm was located, because he knew if John found out, John would take over that operation, and Brian needed that money to help support his family. Brian Waters pleaded with John, "Give me more time, I'm going to pay you back," and that bought him a few months, but by June of 2003, John Wilson had had enough. It was high time Brian be made an example of, so everyone in the drug business would know not to fuck with John Wilson. That's when John Wilson hired a man named Christopher Guest Moore Jr. Do you know him?
No.
Christopher Guest Moore Jr. was hired along with his cousin, who's a thug, by the way, named James Raven, and they were hired to find the location of Brian's cannabis farm. Let me tell you about Christopher. You're going to hate Christopher by the end of this episode. Passionately. 25-year-old Christopher Guest Moore Jr. was born into wealth. When I say he was born into wealth, he had a lot of money. His dad did surveillance and undercover work and was very well known for this and made a ton of money. In fact, the Moores had so much money, they lived in a gated estate known as the Burford Lane Farm in a city called Lyme in England. I've never been to England, but I'm sure Lyme is lovely. The former lacrosse player drove a Porsche Boxster and had a beautiful girlfriend. But his rough around the edges cousin James couldn't be any more different. And I can't wait to tell you about James. People called James the milkman.
Oh, no.
Do you want to know why?
Yeah.
Because he always delivered the goods. I don't think he was working for Amazon. His tattoos advertise his inner disposition. Are you ready for his tattoos?
I can't wait to hear about the tattoos.
Written on his body, in ink, were the words, and I quote, "Approach with caution, extremely violent."
Oh, boy. That's a red flag.
What the fuck is that? He also had a tattoo on his leg that read psychopath and another one that said maniac spelled out on his back.
Damn.
I know. Like,
he's advertising it.
It's insane. Christopher held himself out as a private investigator who worked with both individuals and media companies. One such company that hired him to do contracting was the BBC.
The government?
Oh, yes. And let me tell you, now they are trying to distance themselves from any association with Christopher Guest Moore and James Raven. In 2002, Christopher and James were paid £52,000 by a BBC production team to do undercover research regarding cannabis farms. Now, apparently the 14 months in prison that James did for road rage and his tattoos weren't enough to dissuade them from hiring him. Together, James and Christopher infiltrated England's cannabis industry. They went undercover. and they covertly videotaped some farms for Channel 4's weekly show called Dispatches. And Dispatches wants everybody to know that they did not end up using the video surveillance obtained by these men. According to Christopher, that is how he met and befriended the fierce, gold-toothed drug dealer, John Wilson. A year later, John hired Christopher on a reconnaissance mission to surveil the Waters family and find out where Brian was hiding this cannabis farm. Brian Waters lived with his wife of almost 30 years. Her name was Julie. And they were very happy together. He was a very loyal husband. As I said, family was everything to him, and they were extremely close. They lived in this modest house in Nantwich, England, and that's roughly an hour south of Manchester. The couple had two adult children. They had Gavin, he was 25 years old, and they had Natalie, she was 21. And those children lived in the home with them. Natalie and Gavin would often help their father water and harvest the crops out at the burnt house farm because he spent a lot of time in Holland at the other farm. On June 10th, Christopher began staking out the Waters' house. But the only ones there were Gavin and Natalie because their parents had left on a vacation for the Netherlands and they were gone for almost 3 weeks. That day, Gavin unknowingly led Christopher right to the doorsteps of the burnt house farm. And of course, Christopher reported his findings to John Wilson. John told him, you know, go back to that farm, watch it for a few days, and get an idea of its workings, its comings and goings, who's there, who's not. After a few more days, John Wilson found out that Brian would be returning home. And he put together a team of thugs. The true number of men are not even known to this day, but their sole purpose was to rob the farm and do whatever it took to get the money from Brian Waters. And when I say whatever it took, you have no idea. On the night of June 18th, a man named Otis Matthews, he was Mr. Wilson's right-hand man. He met with Crazy James Raven and Christopher at Christopher's estate. I'm going to tell you about a few other men. And when we do podcasts, I always get weary about mentioning too many people because it becomes really hard to follow. But these guys' names need to be known. Trust me, they need to be known. You don't have to remember them when I'm done. There were at least two other men that were at that meeting. One was a man named Ashley Gerard. He was 30. He was a former European kickboxing champion who had to quit the sport after an injury. And there was another man there named David Moran. Christopher's home served as the gang's headquarters, mostly because it was only 10 miles away from the burnt house farm. Now, the next morning at roughly 4 a.m., these men put their plan to get John Wilson's money at any cost in motion. They drove to the farm and they brought with them this horse box. Do you know what a horse box is?
No.
A horse box is used to transport multiple horses. So you would see it on the highway sometimes. It's got a lot of different slots for the horses to go in. They rented that and they brought it to the farm. Their intent was to steal from the farm and put the stuff into the horse box. I don't know why they wouldn't just rent some sort of moving vehicle.
Right.
I don't know, but they rented a horse box.
All right.
At the farm, inside the house, they found that cannabis growing. And they stole all the dried cannabis they could find, along with any equipment that they thought might be worth stealing. So they loaded up, they put it in the horse box, and Crazy James Raven drove the horse box to a parking lot of a bar near Chris's home. On the way back to the farm, and I don't know who was driving James back, but someone drove James back. On the way, James, Crazy James, stopped to the grocery store, and he bought some sandwiches, some pop, some cigarettes for his motley crew of gangsters waiting at the farm. And yes, I just took an opportunity to say Motley Crue on purpose. I threw that in there for fun. They were waiting there at the farm because they knew Brian was back. He was back in town, and they knew that he would end up showing up there.
So no one was home when they stole all this stuff?
Nobody lived at that farm. They lived in Nantwich.
Oh, that's right.
So they live away. The Waters family actually lives away. And inside the farmhouse is where they're growing the weed.
Right.
They're not actually
living there.
Yeah, or sowing the land with marijuana seeds. After eating their lunch and smoking a ton of cigarettes, the men got antsy. So they went back inside the farmhouse and they just broke everything. They destroyed it just to keep themselves busy. Now, at 11:50 a.m., a car finally pulled into the driveway. And this is where it's going to start getting real ugly. It wasn't Brian. It wasn't Johnny, his partner. But it was Johnny's stepson, 19-year-old Suleiman Razik. And by then, the group of gangsters, they'd grown restless. And they were desperate for some action. But before I tell you what happens next, take a second to buckle up. And then listen to some of the great products from our sponsors. Like Gavin and Natalie, 19-year-old Suleiman Razik earned extra money by helping his stepfather. He watered and harvested the crops. When he arrived that afternoon, he assumed that he was the only one there because there wasn't any other cars. He didn't know that there was an automobile parked in one of the barns. Suleiman exited his car and he walked towards the farmhouse. He put the key in the lock, and as he turned the knob to open it, a group of men wearing gloves and ski masks ran towards him. They punched him and kicked him until he fell to the ground. And then they continued kicking him and punching him. Then they dragged him inside the old farmhouse. He could see it was a mess in there. It was ransacked. Water was dripping from the ceiling. Dirt and plants covered the floor with all these broken clay pots. Once inside, he was beaten some more. And then they just shoved a whole bunch of marijuana leaves and dirt into his mouth. There were at least six men there at the time, and they dragged that 19-year-old outside through the dirt and into a cow shed where his wrists were bound with duct tape. A blue rope was tied around his ankles, and Suleiman was certain he was going to die.
Yeah, for real.
He couldn't see the faces behind the masks, and he didn't recognize any of the voices, and he had no idea why anyone would be beating him. These men were armed with machetes, knives, bamboo canes, and a very real-looking fake gun. Suleiman thought it was real. The beating continued as they demanded Suleiman give them all of his money, which, I mean, he's 19. He didn't have shit.
I was like, how much could he possibly have?
He's just trying to earn some extra money by helping his stepdad out. Repeated punches to his face ended up knocking him unconscious. When he came to, he was hanging upside down by his ankles from a rope tied to a rafter. He'd been hoisted into the air, and he was now staring into the bottom of a green barrel filled with stagnant water. It was right below his head. Slowly, the men began lowering the teen towards the barrel until his head was submerged under the water. All the while, they were taunting him, telling him he was going to die. Then they'd lift him back up a little bit, just enough for him to breathe. They'd say, tell us where the money is, tell us where the money is. But he couldn't tell them what they wanted, so then they would lower him back into the water. While he was strung up, they used some sort of device, maybe a cattle prod, to electrocute him, and that caused his body to involuntarily shake. Once again, Suleiman passed out. This time, when he woke up, he was laying on the cow shed floor. These six men kept inventing new means of torture. They found this large bottle of concentrated phosphoric acid that is used to fertilize the crops. And they poured it on Suleiman's back, with one of them commenting, wow, this stuff's wicked. Phosphoric acid is highly caustic and has a corrosive effect on human skin. Ooh. It eats it away.
Oh, no.
To Suleiman, it felt like he was on fire. The acid caused what was later described as, quote, deep, full thickness burns, end quote.
Oh.
I mean, it just...
That's terrible.
Destroyed his skin.
Oh, my God.
There was no real purpose for this barbaric torture. Yeah, John Wilson wanted to show associates he couldn't be messed with. But none of this was part of John Wilson's original plan. His goal was to get the money. He did tell them, do whatever it takes to get the money. But perhaps it was a groupthink mentality that caused the abuse to escalate because it gets much worse. Perhaps they just enjoyed the power they felt knowing they controlled Suleiman and whether he lived or died. Either way, the torture continued. Using a combination of rope and duct tape, Suleiman was bound to a wooden folding chair It was one of two that were located in the cow shed. I don't know why they were there, but they were there. A pillowcase was placed over this young man's head. Moments later, he heard the sound of spraying, and then he felt the pain of burning flames.
Oh, no.
The men were lighting a combustible spray next to his head. Kind of like back in the day when you would have hairspray right. and hold a lighter and it'd turn into a flame.
Like a flamethrower.
Yes, it was like that. The last thing he felt before he passed out again were pinpricks in his back and shoulders. Then he passed out for a third time. While he was unconscious, they continued using an industrial-grade stapler to shoot staples into his body, including the bottom of his feet.
Oh.
Ow.
They had like a staple gun?
Industrial.
Oh, fuck.
One of those big ones. The sadism lasted about an hour before the sound of another vehicle could be heard entering the driveway. Brian Waters had finally showed up to the burnt house farm. Suliman had only been practice, a dress rehearsal of sorts, and Brian would be the final act. The father of two was attacked as soon as he got out of the car. He was beaten. He was dragged into the barn where he saw the unconscious Suliman sitting bound and bloody. A few minutes later, Suliman regained consciousness, and the vision of Brian will forever be etched in his mind. The six perpetrators tied the same blue rope that they used to suspend Suliman from the rafters around Brian's ankles. He was hoisted into the air. He was lured into that green rain barrel. Suliman watched as Brian ride back and forth in a fruitless attempt to catch air. The men pummeled him repeatedly with a bamboo cane until it snapped. Then they used a metal bar just to continue bashing him. They demanded Ryan pay John Wilson in full. But he didn't have any money. And I am sure if he had any way to pay him, he would have. A knife with a curved blade was passed around, and they all took turns cutting Ryan. During this assault, randomly, Solomon's cell phone began ringing.
Oh, shit.
I'm sure that's what he thought. It was his mom.
Oh, no.
She was calling to check up on him. One of the men held the phone to Suliman's ear, and they forced him to speak with her. He had to assure her he was fine and he'd be home a little later. This is after all that torture
right.
he went through. When the call ended, the torture of Brian resumed. Everything that was done to Suliman was done to Brian, and then some. His face and chest were riddled with industrial staples. At some point during the attack, Brian had been stripped of his pants and underwear. Using the metal bar, I believe it was an iron bar, the men savagely sodomized him. All the while yelling at him, he better turn over the money. The iron bar was forced so far into Brian's rectum that it struck the base of his spine.
Ooh.
The pain was immeasurable, I'm sure. It destroyed his insides. Phosphoric acid was poured all over him. Brian was then bound with rope and duct tape, and he was secured to a wooden folding chair next to Suliman. They continued beating Brian. As they did, they heard the sound of another vehicle approaching. By a twist of unfortunate fate, Brian's two children, Gavin and Natalie, they arrived at the farm at exactly the wrong time.
Oh, no.
Natalie had just celebrated her 21st birthday with her family the day before. That's why her parents came back from vacation, to be sure to be there for her birthday. She pulled up into the farmhouse with her brother, and the two got out of the car. They walked to the front door of the farmhouse, and they were really surprised to find it opened. I mean, that was unusual. As they sheepishly peered inside the doorway, six men ran towards them from the barn. They've got the ski masks on. They're screaming. I'm sure it had to be extremely frightening. One of them had a gun and shouted at them to get the fuck down. Once on the ground, Gavin was kicked, punched over and over again. And if you thought there was any chivalry that was going on, you're wrong, because they hit Natalie too. The siblings were then marched to the barn, where they were greeted with a ghastly scene of seeing their poor father, half naked, burned, beaten, and bound to a chair. And he was bleeding from every part of his body and rectally. His face was swollen beyond recognition. I mean, there's staples in it.
Ooh.
The floor underneath Brian was saturated with blood and vomit. And then, of course, there's Suleiman. He's sitting next to Brian. I don't know exactly why, but I know that he had a quilt on him, and it covered him all the way up to the chest. And then there was a rope tied around his neck. By this time, Brian had endured hours of physical torture. And now his assailants had this opportunity to inflict some mental torture on him as well. I mean, here are his children. So what they did is they tied a rope around Gavin's neck, and then they wrapped it around the rafter, and they threatened to hang Brian's son if he didn't give them the money he owed John Wilson. And you have to ask yourself at this point, do they really believe they're getting any money? Because Brian is, what's he going to go to the bank?
I know.
Right? I mean, I'm just saying, right? Well, where's he going to get the money from?
I know.
If he hasn't given it up yet.
Right. Seriously, like if he hasn't done it by now.
Realizing, I'm sure that he is going to die.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'd be convinced I was going to die.
His spine. Yes. You know, like.
He's going to go to the bank. Yeah, let's just go to the ATM machine. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking.
I think at this point, they just lost control and they got wrapped up in the brutality of it all.
I mean, maybe they thought he had it hidden on site.
Well, I think he would have given it up by then.
For real, seriously.
I think when you're anally raped with a metal bar.
And had acid poured all over you.
Staples. We could go on and on. Yeah, I'm not even done yet.
I know, for real.
Natalie was thrown on the ground by her dad, not far from where he was sitting. And the barrel of the gun was jammed into her mouth. There were comments made about raping her in front of her father and brother. And then they taunted Brian that they were going to kill Natalie. Brian begged and pleaded with them to just please spare his children. He watched as they beat Gavin. And then Gavin and Natalie had to watch as they continued the assault on their father. And to be clear, I'm not exactly sure when Natalie and Gavin arrived. I know they saw their father being tortured. I don't know how much they could have seen him raped. I don't know. But I know they saw him being tortured. And I know they saw this. A large black garbage bag was suspended over Brian's head. It was hanging there. And then the men lit the bag on fire and left as the plastic dripped down onto his face, burning his flesh. Brian began struggling to breathe and begged them to loosen the restraints, but they refused. And by that time, in all likelihood, it wouldn't have changed the outcome of the story. Brian's injuries were so extreme that nothing could have saved him from his imminent death. It had been 3.5 hours of torture before Brian took his last breath and died as his children watched on helplessly.
Aww.
Once he was dead, for whatever reason, they cut his binds and they dragged him into the adjacent milking parlor. And anybody that's been to a milking parlor knows that they're, especially like an old one, it's going to be gross. It's going to be grimy. And they just left him there on the floor. Now, towards the end of all of the torture, while it's still taking place, Christopher and Otis Matthews, they used Brian's car to drive to the Waters family home. They were hoping to find some money there. Brian's 42-year-old wife, Julie, was just doing some chores in the kitchen when they barged through the front door. They ransacked the entire house. And of course, they didn't find any hidden money because Brian would have given it to them already. Realizing there's no cash, they decide to kidnap Julie. Julie was forced to lie down in the backseat of Brian's car. And then they put a comforter over her. And they drove her to the burnt house farm. Now, this is where it gets a little strange. An associate of John Wilson's, and I had mentioned this guy's name to you before. His name is David Moran. It's not clear in the records, and I did get two court memorandums and opinions on this case in an appeal. It's not clear what David Moran's part was in this, and I'm just going to tell you all that I believe he was there at the farm the whole time. But what I know for sure is that he was keeping John Wilson apprised of the situation on the farm. John Wilson was very unhappy when he heard about how things were going on the farm. His henchmen had gone too far and were completely out of control, especially James Raven. John instructed David Moran, who by the way had a burner phone, to go to a payphone and anonymously call the police to report the assault at the burnt house farm. He wanted it to end. From my understanding, David Moran had tried to get James Raven to leave and James wouldn't. So now John Wilson has told him to go and call anonymously.
Damn, that's fucking crazy.
At the time, he didn't know that Brian was already dead. At 4:06 p.m., 999, which is like our 911, received the following anonymous call from a phone booth close to the farm. This is what he says.
Police, new call connecting, payphone 01565.
Thank you, hello police.
Oh, hi. I've just come off the M6.
Yeah.
I'm going towards Northwich, okay?
Yes.
I've got up there, and the first farm on the right-hand side.
Yeah.
It looked like there was three men beating somebody up in the courtyard.
Oh, right. Yeah.
About 500 yards on the right.
How long ago was that?
About 5 minutes.
Do what's your name, please?
Oh, I'm glad I'm not getting involved, you know.
Officers responded within a few minutes to the call for emergency services. They pulled into the property only moments after Christopher and Otis arrived with Julie. In fact, Julie was still in the back seat when she heard the sirens approach. Taken by surprise, the men took off running from the barn, and they forgot something very important. A bag of evidence that they had been collecting.
Oops.
Oops. They were so careful during the crime to put everything, all the trash, everything in a bag so they could take it with them.
And they left the bag?
They left the whole bag.
Oh, no. I mean, good.
James Raven, he was wearing this bright colored jacket, so it made it really easy to spot him in the field because he took off running. And he was detained almost immediately. But the other men managed to escape. The scene was wickedly gruesome, as you can imagine. Both the cowshed and the milking parlor were painted in gore. The police found the plastic grocery bag. Inside it was sandwich wrappers, Sprite cans, some Red Bull, some cigarette butts, and even a pile of human shit.
Oh, that's lovely. Got all kinds of DNA evidence.
Exactly. DNA would later link Christopher Moore to the fecal matter in the bag. He used pieces of cloth from an old stroller, they called a pram, as toilet paper. In the haste to escape authorities, they forgot all that. They literally forgot their shit.
Yeah.
This asshole took a dump and picked it up and put it in a bag.
I mean, you go through the trouble of wanting to clean your tracks, right?
Even your shit.
Yeah, even your shit, and you leave it there.
My question is, why don't you just go into a field or something?
I know.
Why, like, you gotta, you gotta go to the bathroom.
He's on a farm.
Yeah, right? Anyway, totally digressing. At the entrance of the barn, there was a torn black glove, which would later yield a DNA profile that matched Christopher's. They found a mask and another glove near a shed. So while they're running, at some point, they're just tossing their stuff.
Tossing all the evidence.
Further DNA testing linked Christopher to one of the gloves and to a Sprite bottle. But it would be 16 years before authorities would catch up to this killer. He managed to hop a plane at the John London Airport in Liverpool. He flew to Spain and lived on the lam while his cousin James was facing first-degree murder charges. So James Raven, psycho, I can call him that because he's got a tattoo.
Hey, he says so himself.
He's in custody and he says to police, "I only thought we were stealing equipment and maybe some plants. I just went along with it as part of some undercover work for a future TV program called Reefer Madness." That's what he tried to sell them.
Wow.
But the BBC had stopped working with Chris and James Raven months earlier. James claimed to be horrified by the crime. And this is a direct quote from him. "I tried to get them to stop, but they ignored me. I, too, was a victim."
Oh, come on.
"I was a victim in the sense that I saw people being hurt and there was nothing I could do about it. I'm a caring, loving person," end quote. Shut the fuck up.
I know.
Disgusting. Dude. However, Solomon, Gavin, and Natalie later heard his voice and they recognized it, and they pinpointed him as the ringleader at the barn. It makes me so angry to have him say, I too was a victim.
Ugh.
In addition, police found a photo of James Raven that was taken a couple weeks earlier. In this photo, he's wearing a black ski mask. He's holding a hatchet and a fake gun.
And that's all the stuff they found at the farm. What a dumbass.
James said the photo was just a joke.
Oh, sure.
Now, an autopsy was done on Brian Waters.
Oh, no.
And that reflected the inhumane and barbaric abuse that he endured for 3.5 hours in that cow shed. It's so bad. He had 123 external injuries to his body, just on the outside, including bruising, abrasions, lacerations, burns, and cuts. His chest and back showed tramline bruises, and those are caused by being struck by a heavy bar.
Ooh.
His thyroid cartilage was fractured, and they believe that occurred either as a result of strangulation or from a kick to the throat.
Ooh.
And there was a champion kickboxer involved with this, allegedly. The left side of his rib cage had 11 fractures, and the right side had 15, for a total of 26 fractures in his ribs.
Oh my goodness.
His nose was smashed and his sternum was broken. There was bleeding to the surface of his brain, bruising on his heart sac. His left lung had collapsed, which was why he was struggling to breathe. And his other lung was bleeding. So he also had to have this sense of suffocating.
Right.
His anus and rectum were destroyed by the sexual violence. And his actual cause of death was deemed to be a cumulative effect of multiple injuries.
That's just sad. It was so bad.
So bad. Solomon Razek was rushed to the hospital in critical condition. He had lacerations, puncture wounds, bruises, and abrasions, and burns all over his body. His left ear was torn. There were countless staples that had to be removed from him. I mean, all the torture we talk about, my body just clenches up when I say staples.
Well, it's like, I know this is going to sound stupid, but it's like getting a paper cut. They hurt so bad. Like, little wounds like that hurt so bad.
Right.
I'm sure the staple punctures were... They're incredibly painful.
Too. His nose was broken and the bones in his hands were broken.
Mm.
Charred skin covered his back and there were remains of melted wax present. I don't know where the melted wax came from. So there's more torture out there than I even know about. But by the grace of God, the 19-year-old survived. Natalie and Gavin's injuries were minor on the outside. And when I say minor, it's all relative.
Right.
But their mental and emotional scarring, it would stay with them for the rest of their life. The memory of their father's murder is a burden that they have to bear every day. And it will forever cast a shadow on everything they do. 2 days after the murder, as I said, Christopher was on a plane. He was headed to Malaga, Spain. CCTV footage showed him laughing as he was walking in the airport. He's walking next to his girlfriend, and he's carrying this duffel bag, wearing a polo shirt, and just smiling.
Yeah, living it up.
I saw the CCTV footage, and it's just crazy to me. He was in Malaga for about a month before his father flew in to see him, and his father brought with him a suitcase filled with clothes and I don't know what else. I told you his dad worked for intelligence and surveillance, and he ended up helping his son evade capture. A month later, Christopher's mom flew down there, and then after that, he went into official hiding. And the reason why it was a couple months later is because even though all of that happened and the police had James Raven, he didn't at first give anything away. So it took them months to build a case to arrest everybody. When he knew that his arrest was imminent, that's when he went into hiding. But he'd been preparing for it. He spent 6 months in Spain. Then he traveled to South Africa, Mozambique, Turkey, before settling down on the Mediterranean island of Malta, 4 years later.
I hate him.
He got a new British passport with the name Andrew Christopher Lamb, and he began living under the stolen identity. The real Andrew Christopher Lamb was an incapacitated adult who lived in a care home.
That's really sad.
Now, this is going to piss you off so much. When he was in Malta, He was the captain of a luxurious yacht for the wealthy. He became a successful businessman, and he would negotiate import and exports. Some of his clients included the Egyptian military and the Moroccan royal family.
Oh, fuck this guy.
Isn't this unbelievable?
Yes.
He lived in a mansion with a pool in a gated community, and he fell in love with a woman. And I do believe it's his original girlfriend, but I couldn't find anything that confirmed it. I did find something that said that the woman he was with must have been lied to a lot, because when the police spoke with her, she seemed to sincerely have no idea that he was involved in a murder. He owned a Mercedes-Benz and a Porsche at the same time. And I saw this photo of him, and he's such an asshole. In this photo, he's shirtless. He's standing in front of the Porsche and the convertible Mercedes, and he's posing with a gun, pointing it towards the camera.
Are you kidding me?
Like he's some just badass.
Yeah.
His accomplices weren't as lucky as he was. In 2004, not long after Christopher went in hiding, James Raven and John Wilson were sentenced to prison for a minimum of 24 years for conspiracy to commit murder. Now, John Wilson wasn't there for it, but it was his actions that ended up leading to the men gathering to do what they did. He argued that he should get some leniency because he did have David Moran call and try to stop it, but he still ended up getting the same sentence as James Raven. That same year, Christopher's father was sent to jail for 9 months for helping his son escape.
Wow.
Like they were pissed.
Yeah.
Ashley Guichard, he was a former kickboxing champion. He was acquitted of all charges.
He was?
They didn't have any of his DNA. But if you think he went on to be an upstanding citizen, you're wrong. He has a lengthy criminal record. Now, remember David Moran? He made that 999 call.
Mm-hmm.
He was originally charged with murder, but he became a prosecutor witness.
Oh, he turned.
He turned. He pled guilty to doing acts intended to pervert the course of justice. And basically, he admitted to throwing away the burner phone, and he received 21 months. It wasn't until 2007 that John Wilson's right-hand man, Otis Matthews, was sentenced to 22 years for his involvement in the murder and torture. I've said it multiple times already, there are more men that were involved in this crime that have never been identified and got away with it. So Christopher's on the loose. The victims, Solomon, Gavin, Natalie, and Julie, they lived their life in fear because they knew he was still out there. But the police and the Waters family, they never gave up hope that one day he would pay the price for his crimes. In 2019, Christopher was placed on Europe's most wanted list. And this gave the Cheshire police more assistance. There were multiple countries now helping them find Christopher. And Christopher was part of what was called Operation Capture. Operation Capture was an operation formed to hunt down 96 dangerous fugitives in Europe. All the countries were working together to get these guys. Using a, quote, range of specialist capabilities, end quote, they were able to determine that Christopher was in Malta. They never specified exactly what a range of specialist capabilities meant, but I'm sure it was some badass stuff.
Right.
On June 6, 2019, almost 16 years after the brutal assaults and the murder, Christopher Guest Moore was arrested. And he contested his extradition. He said, "You got the wrong man.
Uh-huh.
I am Andrew Lamb.
Let's get some DNA."
Well, they used fingerprints. And it's kind of interesting because Christopher's right thumb and his forefinger were deeply and permanently scarred, making them fingerprintless. I don't know if he did it on purpose. I don't know why. But the rest of his prints matched. And it was March 29th of 2020 that Christopher was extradited to England to face the consequences of his actions. His first trial began in 2021 at the Chester Crown Court. Something happened with that. I'm not sure what, but it only lasted a couple days. And then it was a mistrial. So they had a second trial. He made the same argument as James Raven. He claimed, "I was just there to steal some things. I was doing some undercover work." He said that he was hoping to sell a story about John Wilson being a secret police informant. And I found that really interesting. I wonder if John Wilson was, because why would he use that as a defense?
Right, like just make it up. Where would he get it from?
Where would he get the idea from? Christopher claimed that he left before anyone was attacked. And in his defense, his godfather, his name was Stephen Hayes, he was a former cop and a millionaire private detective. He took the stand and gave Christopher the alibi he needed. He claimed that at the time that the vicious assaults took place and the murder, he was drinking wine with Christopher at a bar. But let me tell you about Stephen. He had this reputation as a corrupt police officer who fabricated evidence.
Oh, shit.
And he was convicted years earlier for corruption.
He's not the most believable person.
Exactly.
To serve as your character witness, right? As your alibi.
As your alibi. So yeah, take the alibi with a grain of salt. Prosecutors presented the DNA evidence found on the Sprite bottle, the glove. There were multiple Marlboro cigarette butts, plus the pile of shit.
Hello.
And the improvised toilet paper. That trial ended in a mistrial.
It did?
The jury couldn't figure it out.
What the hell?
Because he's saying, yeah, I did go to the bathroom there. I did take that Sprite. I did smoke the cigarettes, but I left before it happened. So he's retried again in November of 2021. And this time, after deliberating for 12 hours and 14 minutes, 43-year-old Christopher Guest Moore Jr. was found guilty of conspiracy to commit murder. The vote was 12-2 in favor of his guilt. And in England, it doesn't have to be unanimous.
Huh. Then why? How do you get a mistrial? Oh, maybe you...
You can't get 6-6?
Yeah, I guess so, right?
Mm-hmm.
All you'd have to do is convince one person?
They couldn't.
Jeez.
He was given the mandatory life sentence, and that doesn't mean exactly what you think it means. He has to serve a term of 24 years before he can be considered for release by the parole board. For Suleiman Razak's torture, he received another 14 years to be done concurrently. Now, at the trial, Suleiman Razak spoke. He's married. He's older now. He said, quote, "Nearly every day since I've thought about what happened or I've had a flashback, I'm still physically scarred in numerous places, and these are constant reminders to me. I've had so many sleepless nights. Even now I have terrible nightmares where I relive what happens. The memories all come back to me, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. I know these will never go away," end quote. He also said that he has to hide his back. He always has to wear a shirt because he doesn't want his children to see
Aww.
The scars. Natalie Waters spoke to the court on behalf of her family. She said, quote, "We avoid going to public places. We do not trust anyone around us. Every single day, I have memories of what happened flash into my head. Anytime. Day. Night. Whenever I think about my dad, I always see the image of him in the chair suffering. Since the incident, we still live together without being able to move on. The verdict today marks the end of an incredibly painful journey in our lives," end quote.
Aww. They all live together, like Mom and Gavin and her?
Yeah, and there was more they went on to say. I mean, this happened during COVID, so they were like, you know how you feel with COVID and you're all trapped inside your house and you can't go anywhere. That's how we feel every day since the crime.
That's so sad.
Very, very sad. I need to tell everybody, I got a lot of my information from, as I said, the court records, which I was surprised I could get for England. I got stuff from the LancashireTelegraph.co.uk article, CaseMine.com, and I'll list the rest of the sources in our notes. And that's the end of the story.
How awful.
That's just,
jeez.
Fucking horrible.
Over some weed?
Right.
I know, it's not to minimize it, but jeez.
Over some money.
Yeah, over money. Wow. And it's not even like he stole it. It got confiscated.
I know.
You know, like, that's the cost of doing business when you're selling illegal shit.
I mean, damn. I don't know. I feel bad for Brian. That's just one of the most awful ways to go. And to watch your children suffer is the biggest nightmare for parents. I mean.
For hours.
Hours. I want to thank everybody who stuck around and listened to that whole thing. Because it was awful. And if you haven't done so already, go ahead and just hit that subscribe or follow button, whatever you have. And if you want to hear more from us, you've already gone through all of our playlist, check out us on Patreon. You can go to our website to learn more about it, crimesandconsequences.com. I counted, Tanya, and we have about 170 episodes for anybody that subscribes to our Apple channel podcast or joins us on Patreon.
Wow.
Yeah, right? It's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. That's because we do a lot of work.
Yeah, we say a lot of F-bombs. Mm-hmm. And some of those stories are pretty nasty. It's a lot more raw. So check it out. And also check us out on social media. Our hashtag is Hardcore True Crime. And we have a few shout-outs.
We do.
These are our newest Apple Podcast subscribers or Patreon members for the that have joined us in the past 5 days. Philippa, Corey with a K, Adriana, NF. What's NF? Somebody's never fucking mind.
None of your fucking business.
Val Getty and Brianna.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
We hope you're enjoying all the extra episodes you have access to now.
Oh, they are.
I'm sure of it.
And for all you that are going to CrimeCon in Las Vegas on April 29th through May 1st, come visit us on Podcast Row.
Yes, please come visit us. We would love to see all of you.
Yeah, it'll be great. I'm super excited.
Me too.
Anything else, Tanya?
No, Talia. I think we covered all of our business.
All right. Until next week, do not kill each other.
Bye. Bye.